This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ramona Nafee with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading theater and movie reviews to you from around the Triangle region. We only have one upcoming theater event. That's a Balanchine celebration and happening on October 28th with the audio described performance at 2 p.m., that October 28th matinee. We do have a couple of other, well, actually several other theater events coming up in early November and then into December. So if you wanted to start making those plans. In early November, we have Jersey Boys coming up on November 1st, Shining City on November 4th, Imaginary Invalid on November 6th, and Catch Me As If You Can on November 10th. So quite a few described shows going on in early November. And we'll have, of course, more details on those as we get into November. Then for December, to start making some of these very advanced plans, on December 1st, you'll have a choice between Shrek and A Christmas Story. On December 2nd, Burning Coal is doing As You Like It. On December 11th, It's a Wonderful Life. And then right up to Christmas, on December 23rd, the described performance of the Carolina Ballet's The Nutcracker. And then later in the program, we have 10 movies to get through. We have the sort of current events movie, Argo, and then several science fiction and sort of Halloween horror movies, Looper, Paranormal Activity 4, Sinister, and Taken 2. And then the animated films Frank and Weenie and Hotel Transylvania. And then at the end, some of the light comedies, Fun Size, Here Comes the Boom, and Pitch Perfect. So we'll start this off with the Carolina Ballet. They are doing a Balanchine celebration with a performance on October 28th at 2 p.m. Not only was George Balanchine the founding artistic director and choreographer of New York City Ballet, he choreographed on Broadway and in Hollywood as well. Holding a long-standing personal relationship with George Gershwin, Balanchine created Who Cares? As an homage to Gershwin's work. He challenged anyone leaving the theater after experiencing Who Cares? Not to be walking on air. And this collection of Balanchine's works is being done by the Carolina Ballet. You can learn more by going to their webpage, www.carolinaballet.com, or you can call the ballet line at 919-719-0900. And again, the described performance will be October 28th at 2 p.m. We do have a review by Denise Carniglia of Triangle Arts and Entertainment. It's titled Carolina Ballet and the Gift of Balanchine. Although choreography by George Balanchine has been part of the Carolina Ballet repertoire for all of its 14 seasons, these performances continue to be a rare treat. Unlike the work in literature or on canvas of great artists, a dance is fleeting. On opening night of Carolina Ballet's A Balanchine Celebration, the dancers captured the clean and intricate lines, the fast footwork connected intimately to music, and the moods, from sublime to playful, that make Balanchine's work stand out above so many others. The show opened with Apollo, a dramatic portrayal of the Greek god with his muses. With the self-admiring, lute-playing god, this ballet might run the risk of appearing ridiculous, less skillfully danced. Timur Bortesnikov danced the part of Apollo with sensitivity, commanding, and statuesque poise. Power seemed to alternate between Bortesnikoff and the Muses, Alicia Fabry, Lindsay Partington, and Lillian Vigo, whose smooth entanglements were mesmerizing. The fun and lively pas-de-deux Tarantella followed, with sprightly Margaret Severin Hansen and Pablo Javier Perez. Valse fantasy is everything that is good about a waltz, with arms and long chiffon skirts whipping around and encircling the dancers like wisps of smoke. Jan Burkhardt and Richard Crush were classically vibrant, accented by a core of four flowing in perfect unison. Agon, pas de deux, is a visually striking dance featuring the extension, focus, and control of Laura O'Brien and Eugene Barnes. The pair was perfectly suited to the geometrically and musically challenging choreography. This is a piece of modern art, with its pleasant but unemotional expressions and monochromatic aesthetic matched to the music of Igor Stravinsky. The last piece, Who Cares, is a whimsical ballet of 15 short dances set to well-known George Gershwin tunes. Margaret Severin Hansen and Gabor Kapan were masters of subtlety in the tender pas de deux, The Man I Love, an intimate conversation between lovers. In Embraceable You, Lillian Vigo was exquisite, joining Kapan for an eloquent uptown pas de deux. Jan Burkhardt was full of youthful enthusiasm, exploding from the floor in the solo I'll Build a Stairway to Paradise. The company came together for the finale, I Got Rhythm. Superfast turns and jumps exposed flashes of pink from the bottom layers of the dancers' skirts designed by Steven Rubin. Randy Ostick's ease of movement and high extensions were consistently eye-catching in Who Cares, even with 14 fast-moving dancers on stage. The live musical accompaniment provided by pianist Carl Murawski, drummer Scott Lane, and bassist Robbie Link kept the energy high. The genuine smiles throughout the ballet suggested the dance was as much a gift for the dancers as for the audience. This is a sophisticated program, well suited to highbrow tastes. But there's no reason to wait for a story ballet to introduce children to classical dance. People, including kids, who like art in any form will love these ballets. The dances are short, interesting, and unexpected. They're bright and colorful and musically and aesthetically interesting and smart. These dances might open the door for great conversations about the place of history and literature in art, and about a person using what he or she finds interesting in the world to create something of lasting impact. And once again, the show is October 28th at 2 p.m., and you can call the ballet line at 919-719-0900. Now, we do have a couple of other pieces by the North Carolina Symphony to draw your attention to. And this is all in early November. On Saturday, November 3rd, or Friday and Saturday, November 2nd and 3rd, in Mamandi Concert Hall, they will be doing Song of the Earth. This is Haydn's Symphony No. 7 and Mahler's The Song of the Earth. And then the following week, Friday, November 9th, again at Mamandi in Raleigh, we have Mozart's Prague Symphony, with several pieces by Dukas, Debussy, Dvorak, Weber, and, of course, Mozart's Symphony No. 38. And as they say, an interesting thing here, the Friday, November 9th concert will be performed entirely without intermission. And you can contact them at 919-733-2750 or look this information up online at ncsymphony.org. Their phone number again, 919-733-2750. As I said, we have lots of movies to get to. These are showing at Regal North Hills Stadium 14 in Raleigh and Regal White Oak Stadium 14 in Garner. Now, I confirmed these movies at the Garner location, but very strangely, I was unable to confirm that they're showing at North Hills in Raleigh. They were showing just a few days ago, but there was a glitch in the system, and I couldn't confirm it today. So, you know, please call these theaters in advance, make sure that they're showing, and find out the times. So those phone numbers for North Hills Stadium, this is the Raleigh Theater, it's 919-786-4494. Again, 786-4494. And then the Garner Theater, White Oak Stadium 14, is 919-676-3456. Got a very nice, easy to remember number in Garner, 676-3456. So the movies we have to go through are Argo, Looper, Paranormal Activity 4, Sinister, Taken 2, Frankenweenie, Hotel Transylvania, Fun Size, Here Comes the Boom, and Pitch Perfect. We begin with Argo. Based on true events, Argo chronicles the life-or-death covert operation to rescue six Americans, which unfolded behind the scenes of the Iran hostage crisis, the truth of which was unknown by the public for decades. On November 4, 1979, as the Iranian Revolution reaches its boiling point, militants storm the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, taking 52 Americans hostage. But in the midst of the chaos, six Americans manage to slip away and find refuge in the home of the Canadian ambassador. Knowing it's only a matter of time before the six are found out and likely killed, a CIA exfiltration specialist named Tony Mendez comes up with a risky plan to get them safely out of the country, a plan so incredible it could only happen in the movies. And this is reviewed by Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times. At the height of the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis, with yellow ribbons tied around half of the old oak trees in America, a CIA agent and a couple of Hollywood professionals dreamed up a cockamamie scheme to free six Americans who had found refuge in the Canadian embassy. Their existence had to remain a secret to protect Canada's diplomatic status. Enter the CIA extractor, Tony Mendez, a producer named Lester Siegel, and a makeup man named John Chambers. Chambers has a brainstorm. He and Siegel would fabricate a fake sci-fi thriller named Argo. They would commission a screenplay, pay for storyboards, and buy a big ad in Variety. Mendez would fly alone into Tehran and train the six Americans to impersonate Hollywood pros, the cinematographer, and so on. Their cover? They needed desert locations for their movie, which would vaguely resemble Star Wars. They would tell the Iranians the six people were Canadians who were scouting locations and now needed to fly back to North America. One of the most enchanting scenes has Mendez showing the sci-fi storyboards to Iranian authorities who try their best to conceal what movie buffs they are. At the end of the scene, when Mendez tells them, "Ah, you can keep them," they're like kids being given an E.T. poster by Steven Spielberg. Now, this preposterous scheme is based on fact. Yes, it is. Countless movies are inspired by real events, but this one truly took place. The extraction of the six Americans remained top secret for 18 years. They all returned safely to America. Argo, needless to say, was never filmed. Now, Ben Affleck not only stars in, but directs. And Argo, the real movie about the fake movie, is both spellbinding and surprisingly funny. Many of the laughs come from the Hollywood guys played by Goodman and Arkin, although to be sure, as they set up a fake production office and hold meetings poolside at the Beverly Hills Hotel, they aren't in danger like the crew members in Iran. Key supporting roles are filled by Bryan Cranston as the CIA chief who greenlights the scheme, and Victor Garber as the Canadian ambassador who, at great risk, opens his embassy's doors to the secret guests. Affleck is brilliant at choreographing the step-by-step risks that the team takes in exiting Tehran, and Argo has cliffhanging moments when the whole delicate plan seems likely to split at the seams. The craft in this film is rare. It is so easy to manufacture a thriller from chases and gunfire, and so very hard to fine-tune it out of exquisite timing and a plot that's so clear to us we wonder why it isn't obvious to the Iranians. I mean, after all, who in their right mind would believe a space opera was being filmed in Iran during the hostage crisis? Well, just about everyone, it turns out. Hooray for Hollywood. And now a series of sci-fi and Halloween thrillers. We have Looper. In the futuristic action thriller Looper, time travel will be invented, but it will be illegal and only available on the black market. When the mob wants to get rid of somebody, they will send their target 30 years into the past, where a looper, a hired gun like Joe, is waiting to mop up. Joe is getting rich and life is good, until the day the mob decides to close the loop, sending back Joe's future self for assassination. And this review is also by Roger Ebert of Chicago Sun-Times. Rian Johnson's Looper, a smart and tricky sci-fi story, sidesteps the paradoxes of time travel by embracing them. Most time travel movies run into trouble in the final scenes when impossibilities pile up upon one another. This film leads to a startling conclusion that wipes out the story's paradoxes so neatly, it's as if it never happened. You have to grin at the ingenuity of Johnson's screenplay. The movie takes place in 2044 and 2074, both of which look like plausible variations of the American present. And then there are a few scenes set in a futuristic Shanghai. We learn that although time travel is declared illegal once it has been discovered, a crime syndicate cheats and uses it as a method for disposing of its enemies. Now imagine this. A man with a shotgun stands by himself in a field. A second man materializes. This thin air guy, who's bound and hooded, is a man from the future who's been sent back in time to be assassinated. The shotgun guy is known as a looper. He has been sent back in time to be the trigger man. Eventually, when he grows old enough, he will be sent back in time to be killed by his younger self. This is known as closing the loop. Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays Joe, the trigger man in 2044. Bruce Willis plays old Joe, sent back from the future. The loop is not closed, however, because old Joe arrives without a hood, and young Joe hesitates when he realizes his latest target is himself. He knew that it would happen eventually. It's part of the deal. But a hood would have prevented him from knowing which victim was himself. And this leads to the kind of weird scene that only time travel makes possible. The two Joes go to a nearby diner, grab a booth, and have a conversation. Imagine that you're sitting across from yourself with a 3-decade age difference. This is an opening for an endless conversation about the emotional and metaphysical implications of the meeting, but Johnson, perhaps wisely, makes their conversation more pragmatic. Perhaps professional hitmen aren't inclined towards philosophy. So think this through. If the loop is closed on you, did you never exist? Did you live your younger life up until the point you killed your older self? I mean, Looper, to its credit, doesn't avoid this question. It's up to you to decide if it answers it. Time travel may be logically impossible, but once we allow a film to use it, we have to be grateful if it makes sense according to its own rules. Rian Johnson's first feature was the well-received, low-budget indie titled Brick, which told a high school story in a film noir style. The second was the con man puzzlement, The Brothers Bloom. Now time travel. In all three, he begins with generic expectations and then confounds them. The key is in his writing. Looper weaves between past and present in a way that gives Johnson and his actors opportunities to create a surprisingly involved narrative. Our next movie is Paranormal Activity 4. This is the fourth film in the Paranormal Activity franchise. The review is by Adam Markovitz of Entertainment Weekly. Suburban teen Alex gets increasingly freaked out as her little brother cozies up to his weirdo neighbor who says he has an invisible friend. It's a new house with a new family in it, but everything else in Paranormal Activity 4 will look pretty familiar to fans who come for the series' signature trick of sneaking haunted house scares into the background of surveillance footage. I mean, this time the recording is done with new gadgets like smartphones and the infrared camera of a Microsoft Kinect video game console, but the goal is still the same, scaring you witless with anticipation. And by that standard, PA4 pales in comparison to the original trilogy. Writer-directors Ariel Schulman and Henry Joost have their heads too far into the franchise's mythology, which concerns a woman named Katie who seems to be linked to a demonic spirit. PA4 develops the story ever so slightly, not enough to satisfy fans, and delivers a few scares, not enough to satisfy newbies. Mostly it plays like an overlong prologue for the already in the works PA5. Here's hoping this is just the tension-racking lull before the next big scream. Our final sci-fi movie is Sinister. A true crime novelist struggling to find his next big story discovers a box of home videos showing other families being brutally murdered, but his investigation soon leads him to a supernatural entity that may be placing his own family in harm's way. And this review is by Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly. When a horror movie is derivative, that's usually, in my book, a point against it. But Sinister, a mashup of half a dozen other films, not only contains a few honestly terrifying jolts, it's also the rare horror movie that's just ingenious enough about stitching together everything it borrows to make its secondhand quality kind of fun. Ellison Oswalt, a celebrity author of true crime novels, played by Ethan Hawke at his most antsy and compelling, is a knockoff of Jack Torrance in The Shining, a writer struggling to produce, who likes his whiskey too much, whose work lures him towards mental instability, and who moves his wife and kids into a home where gruesome murders took place. A family was hanged in burlap hoods from a tree in the backyard, and Ellison is investigating the killings. We see the bodies hanging and swaying in grainy, amateur footage, and there's almost a poetic eeriness to the image. That shot is part of a film that Ellison discovers in the attic in a box of old 8mm reels, most of them from decades ago. The film canisters contain silent home movies of different families, swimming, enjoying a barbecue, or not doing very much at all, and the footage is intercut with grisly, snuff movie images of each family getting slaughtered in a hideous fashion. It all looks a lot like the home movies the hero of Michael Mann's Manhunter uses to track down a serial killer. And Ellison, for all of his Torrance-like torment, is a lot like that film's FBI profiler. At the same time, he keeps freeze-framing the footage, combing it for a clue to the killer's identity, just like the hero of Blow Up. What he starts to catch glimpses of is a face that looks more than a bit like a latter-day Michael Jackson. That is, if he'd returned from the dead to portray a goblin in Paranormal Activity 6. Now, my favorite thing from Sinister is derived from Ringu, though in a way that connects it to a film I didn't even care for that much, last summer's Super 8. It's that notion of grainy amateur footage shot with a primitive ramshackle camera as a looking glass into the past, the world of analog mystery. In Sinister, digital technology, like the computer onto which Ellison transfers these scratchy old films, is lit by rationality, whereas Super 8 footage, in its blurry shadings and fuzzy warm colors, has a lack of exactitude that allows it to contain only ghosts. The movie was directed by Scott Derrickson, who made the misbegotten possession thriller The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and he's basically made a don't-go-in-the-attic movie that deftly cannibalizes the horror genre without a hint of an ironic wink. I knew perfectly well, after a while, what Sinister was going to scare me with. But I got scared anyway. Now, other movies that we have are Taken 2, Liam Neeson returns as Brian Mills, the retired CIA agent with a particular set of skills who stopped at nothing to save his daughter Kim from Albanian kidnappers. When the father of one of the kidnappers swears revenge and takes Brian and his wife hostage during their family vacation in Istanbul, Brian enlists Kim to help them escape and uses the same advanced level of special forces tactics to get his family to safety and systematically take out the kidnappers one by one. We also have the animated movies, Frank and Weenie. From creative genius Tim Burton comes Frank and Weenie, a heartwarming tale about a boy and his dog. After unexpectedly losing his beloved dog, Sparky, young Victor harnesses the power of science to bring his best friend back to life. We also have Hotel Transylvania, Dracula's lavish five-stake resort, where monsters and their families can live it up, free from meddling in the human world. For Dracula, catering to all these legendary monsters is no problem, but his world could come crashing down when one ordinary guy stumbles onto the hotel and takes a shine to Dracula's daughter. Then we have, in the light comedy arena, Fun Size, a teen comedy centered on a sarcastic high school senior who's eager to distance herself from her dysfunctional family, but her mother insists that she watch her little brother Albert on Halloween night. And, of course, Rin gets distracted, Albert disappears, and everyone embarks on an unlikely high-stakes all-night adventure to find the brother, crossing paths with outrageous characters every step of the way. There is Here Comes the Boom. Kevin James stars as a high school biology teacher who moonlights as a mixed martial arts fighter in an effort to raise money to save the school's music program. And our final movie, Pitch Perfect. Becca is that girl who'd rather listen to what's coming out of her headphones than what's coming out of you. Arriving at her new college, she finds herself not right for any clique, but somehow muscled into one that she would never have picked on her own, alongside mean girls, sweet girls, and weird girls, whose only thing in common is how good they sound when they sing together, in the new out loud comedy Pitch Perfect. When Becca takes this acoustic singing group out of their world of traditional arrangements and perfect harmonies into all new mashups, they fight to climb their way to the top of the cutthroat world of college a cappella. This could wind up either as the coolest thing they'll ever do or the most insane, and it will probably be a little bit of both. So all of these movies are playing right now with descriptive video. You can call the theaters to find out exact show times. At Regal North Hills Stadium 14 in Raleigh, the number is 919-786-4494. And at Regal White Oak Stadium 14 in Garner, it's 919-676-3456. Again in Raleigh, 919-786-4494, and in Garner, 676-3456. And with that, we have run out of time for this evening's evening's reviews. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ramona Nafe, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Please listen in next time.